certainly come within the parameters of a high crime and misdemeanor to bring a nation to war based on false information.
There's been a lot of speculation what's going to be the next war after Iraq, and I think the most likely candidate is Iraq.
Soldiers there did look a little nervous, and one of them said to me, well, we think this is an accident waiting to happen, and we're not quite sure why we're here.
We have a history of trampling on civil liberties during wartime in the name of national security. 20 years later, the historians write it didn't help national security, and we apologize.
Today, we are witnessing a true and historic maturation of the peace movement.
This is Pacifica's Peace Watch for Tuesday, June 10th, 2003. I'm Verna Avery Brown. Saddam Hussein has been seen north of Baghdad and is paying a bounty for every American soldier killed. That's according to the leader of an Iraqi exile group quoted in today's Washington Times. Saddam Hussein has $1.3 billion in cash taken from the central bank on March 18th, is bent on revenge, and believes he can sit it out and get the Americans going, said Ahmed Chalabi, head of the Iraqi National Congress. In Washington today, Pentagon officials said they had no information that Hussein was alive and offering bounties for killing U.S. troops. But Chalabi says Hussein also bought suicide vests for himself and his secretary on April 1st from the Mukhabarat, the Iraqi secret police. The ousted Iraqi leader has been sighted on several recent occasions moving in an arc from Diyala, northeast of Baghdad, around the Tigris River toward his hometown of Tikrit and into the Dulami areas in the west of the Tigris, said Chalabi. The latest sighting was about 2 weeks before Chalabi left on his current U.S. trip, and the best sighting was 3 days old. Chalabi says now he's put a price on American soldiers. He will pay bounty for every American soldier killed in Iraq. This has been spread around in the western part of the country. Chalabi made his comments to the Council on Foreign Relations. According to a U.S. government report released today, there is a high probability that al-Qaeda will attempt an attack with a weapon of mass destruction in the next 2 years. The report to a U.N. Security Council committee monitoring sanctions against the terrorist group did not say where the Bush administration believes such an attack might be launched. But the United States said it believes that despite recent setbacks, al-Qaeda maintains the ability to inflict significant casualties in the U.S. with little or no warning. The al-Qaeda network will remain for the foreseeable future the most immediate and serious terrorism threat facing the U.S., the report said. Al-Qaeda will continue to favor spectacular attacks, but also may seek softer targets of opportunity, such as banks, shopping malls, supermarkets, and places of recreation and entertainment. The report said the terrorist organization will continue its efforts to acquire and develop biological, chemical, radiological, and nuclear weapons. The al-Qaeda threat persists, and the group's mastermind, Osama bin Laden, remains unaccounted for in spite of a U.S. invasion into Afghanistan following al-Qaeda's attack on the World Trade Centers and the Pentagon on 9/11. The recent invasion of Iraq was launched in part because of links the Bush administration says exist between bin Laden and Iraq's deposed President Saddam Hussein. While the head of the U.S. installed government in post-Saddam Iraq, Paul Bremer, held a press conference today amid growing discontent from Iraqi citizens. According to the International Committee of the Red Cross, hospitals are still lacking medical supplies and administrative staff to coordinate the efforts of humanitarian agencies. Because electricity has not been restored, clean water is in limited supply. Many working in the hospitals have not been paid, and phone service has not been restored to most of Iraq. Eileen Prusher, Middle East staff writer for the Christian Science Monitor, is stationed in Baghdad, and she was at the Bremer press conference today. She spoke with Peace Watch earlier today.
One of the main reasons why Mr. Bremer called the press conference was in order to talk about the Iraqi economy. He made an announcement that the U.S. and its allies were setting up a $100 million construction fund to work on improving infrastructure, helping people get back to work, etc., and that they would try to start helping Iraqi businesses get off the ground and encourage free markets, economy, etc. But I think, one thing that you could say about it, that people were interested in that, but the media seemed to keep taking Mr. Brimmer away from the economic issues, which he meant to speak about today, and had a lot of questions about the political situation and, of course, the security situation, which has continued to be problematic, especially if you're a U.S. soldier posted in Iraq.
Well, what are the dangers for U.S. soldiers posted in Iraq?
Well, you know, for U.S. soldiers, I mean, the attacks seem to be mostly localized. There have been a few in various places, but the two places that seem to be kind of ongoing difficult points for the U.S. military continue to be the area west of Baghdad, the area called Fallujah or Ramadi, and also the area around Tikrit, which, of course, was Saddam Hussein's hometown. There seem to be attacks on U.S. soldiers in either one of those two places. It's seeming to be almost every day now, if not every other day. They've started to, you know, have success in killing one or two soldiers when these attacks occur. And it is a concern, of course, for the military. And it's really difficult for them to rout or to quash because, of course, you know, these are small groups who are using the cover of houses, according to the military. The attack yesterday, for example, in Fallujah, they shot from a mosque. And it seems that it's going to be pretty challenging for the military to deal with this at the same time that they're trying to get on with the whole job of aiding in the reconstruction and redevelopment of Iraq.
Mm-hmm. Well, so the reports indicate that 29 U.S. soldiers have been killed in Iraq since the heaviest fighting reportedly ended, the military phase of the operation that President Bush announced was over. 29 soldiers, U.S. soldiers, mm-hmm. have been killed. Are these isolated instances of violence, or what do you think? Do these represent a broader sense of anger and resentment and discontent on the part of the Iraqi people?
Well, it's difficult to characterize. There are different cross-sections of society. There are areas that felt loyal to Saddam Hussein, or at least loyal to the Ba'ath Party that he represented. And some of those people still think, well, Saddam's out there. Perhaps he could come back. Perhaps we can chase the U.S. soldiers out. If we keep attacking them, they'll leave and we'll get Saddam back. You know, even if that's not very realistic, you do hear that from some people. And then you just hear from some other people, they feel this sense of insecurity. They feel unhappy with the pace of U.S. sort of moving on to passing on the torch of, let's say, civilian administration, as it were, onto some kind of Iraqi interim authority. So there is a lot of frustration coming from that. And you also can find many Iraqis who say, well, we don't want the Americans to leave until we can be sure that we can have a sort of civil democracy that will take root after they leave. So, again, there is a lot of frustration out there, but you can't say that these attacks represent everybody. They probably represent people who were not happy to see the Americans come here in the first place.
Well, have you personally interviewed any of the people? Or anybody that's saying, well, we're loyal to Saddam Hussein and therefore we're going to launch these attacks against the U.S. troops?
Yeah, I have interviewed people like that in Tikrit. And then when I was in Fallujah just last week, where there have been a lot of attacks on U.S. soldiers, what I found was more, not that we're so loyal to Saddam or that we think he should come back or that we want him back, but that we want the Americans out. They don't belong here. This is our country. What are they doing here? They're trying to steal our resources. All sorts of things like that. I think there's a great degree of misunderstanding and rumor that goes around about what the U.S. is here to do. And, you know, that seems to be a reason for it, not so much that it's all about Saddam, but, you know, if we start attacking them, they'll leave more quickly. Certainly, you do hear a lot of people accusing the U.S. of coming to Iraq to steal its oil and other resources or to put its sort of footprint in the region and control the Middle East, etc. You hear lots of different theories of why that is. But yes, I think there is some skepticism and fear on the part of a lot of Iraqis. They don't know how long the U.S. is going to stay. And I think that the longer it takes for the U.S. to come up with some kind of interim Iraqi authority, you know, the more problematic it's going to be because Iraqis will say, well, how long are the Americans, how long will they stay and how long is it going to take before we can look towards a new and indigenous Iraqi leadership?
Is there a sense of uneasiness from the troops as a result of them coming under fire since the end of the war?
I think there is. Depends really on which troops you talk to and where they're based. But I know, for example, about a week or so ago, I talked to some soldiers who were posted in front of a large mosque in Baghdad and said, you know, how do you feel here? It's Friday prayers and you're sort of stationed smack in front of this mosque. You know, that might be considered an irritating presence to some people. And the soldiers there did look a little nervous, and one of them said to me, well, we think this is a sort of really an accident waiting to happen, and we're not quite sure why we're here. And then, lo and behold, 2 days later, soldiers at exactly that mosque were attacked. I believe one was killed.
Eileen Prusher, Middle East staff writer for the Christian Science Monitor in Baghdad, Iraq. In what the Washington Post called the most extensive global realignment of the U.S. military forces since the end of the Cold War, the Defense Department is creating a network of U.S. military bases from which to implement their doctrine of preemptive attack against terrorists and hostile states. Zoltan Grossman, assistant professor of geography at University of Wisconsin-Eau Claire, has been researching this trend of setting up bases in the aftermath of military interventions and its implications. We asked him about the far-flung network of military bases the U.S. is currently setting up.
Well, I think it's in keeping with the pattern of U.S. military interventions, particularly in the area between Eastern Europe and South Asia. Every single one of the large-scale U.S. military interventions in the last 15 years has left behind a new string of U.S. military bases in a part of the world where the U.S. military never had a permanent presence. So after the Gulf War, bases left behind in Saudi Arabia and the Gulf states, and of course the bases in Saudi Arabia contributing to the rise of Al-Qaeda, the Balkans Wars in Bosnia and Kosovo in 95 and 99, leaving behind bases in countries not only Bosnia and Kosovo, but places like Hungary, Macedonia. After the Afghan War of 2001, a permanent presence in Pakistan, some of the ex-Soviet Central Asian states such as Uzbekistan, Kyrgyzstan, Tajikistan. And now, after the invasion, because the occupation is actually a new phase of the war, and one of the reasons for the occupation is to secure these new bases in Iraq, partly to substitute for the very risky presence in Saudi Arabia, mm-hmm. but partly also to project a permanent military presence into this very strategic region, strategic for much more than oil.
Well, and so, I mean, you're saying this is in keeping with how the U.S. has performed throughout history. And some of the reports we're hearing, in fact, say that over the past 2 years, there's been a rapid expansion of deployments stretching across, as you say, the Balkans, to the Chinese border, taking in the Caucasus, Central Asia, the Middle East, the Indian subcontinent, and now growing interest in sub-Saharan Africa. Is that in keeping, too, with U.S. foreign policy, or is this unprecedented in any way? Are we seeing an accelerated rate of this expansion under the Bush administration?
I think we're definitely seeing an accelerated rate, and both under the Bush administration and under the Clinton administration, that actually we pay a lot of attention to what happens during a war, but in fact what happens after the war contributes to future wars. And if we look at this region geographically, we're really looking at the area between Hungary and Pakistan, including the Balkans, including the Middle East, including part of South Asia. And if you look at all these various interventions and the bases they've left behind, in 1989 we really only had bases in Turkey, Italy, Diego Garcia in the Indian Ocean, Somalia. But when you look at the presence now, it's a continuous belt from Hungary, and I believe Poland is planning to have U.S. military base, from Poland down to Pakistan. And the only obstacles left in the way of a contiguous U.S. military sphere of influence are Syria and Iran. Iraq was in the way, but it is now out of the way. And so if you look at kind of the long-term U.S. strategy, it isn't some conspiracy, but it's definitely responding to crises as an opportunity to project a U.S. presence into this region between the two emerging economic competitors of the United States, the European Union and East Asian powers such as China and Japan.
So how many, can we talk numbers? How many number of bases, U.S. military bases, are there throughout this region?
It's somewhere in the neighborhood now of about 25, if you're looking all the way from Poland to Pakistan. Of those, there were a few in Turkey that were there before the first Gulf War. But pretty much all of them are new.
Mm-hmm. New since 1989?
Right, new since 1989.
25 U.S. military bases have been established since 1989.
Right, and some, and it's important to look at it not simply as a base, as a place, but also as basing rights in particular facilities where the U.S. can move in and out at will. We see that some of the countries where the U.S. was actually kicked out, Somalia in 1993, Philippines around the same time, Yemen, there's a very strong tendency in the Pentagon to find terrorists in those countries in order to reestablish a U.S. military presence.
Or a reason for it.
Right.
Justification for it. And so in your article, New U.S. Military Bases, Side Effects or Causes of War, you write about the geopolitical priorities of the U.S. and why the U.S. went to war in all these countries, even as peaceful options remained available. And you tied in the wars in the Persian Gulf, Somalia, the Balkans, Afghanistan, saying they were all preventable wars, which all resulted in the establishment of these new U.S. military bases. So there appears to be an agenda at hand beyond the interest of oil profits. Would you agree?
Yeah, I think that not everything can be reduced to oil. Oil is one aspect of economic power, and I think in particular that what the French president, Jacques Chirac, has been saying since the first Gulf War is the U.S. presence in the Middle East is not simply for oil. Obviously, we don't get much of our oil from the Middle East. We only get a small proportion. It's not even necessarily just for oil profits. U.S. Corporations get the overwhelming share of profits. But it's also to control the spigot of oil, to control others' access to oil. So the European Union and East Asia are very dependent on Middle Eastern oil. They are the emerging economic competitors to the United States. So the United States is placing itself in a good political economic position by dominating the region where the oil is the richest. So it has a little bit more to do with the actual access to oil than necessarily the oil itself. But simply having a presence between the European Union and East Asia prevents those economic powers from taking control, for instance, in linking the oil to the euro instead of the dollar, et cetera, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
There tends to be an economic reason for this permanent presence.
And so when you speak of the oil being linked to the euro as opposed to the dollar, that poses a serious economic threat to the U.S.
Yeah, so I think that poses a serious economic threat. I think the priority of the people of many of these countries, Iran, Iraq, for example, to have their oil nationalized, to have control over their own oil profits, poses and has posed for a long time a threat to U.S. oil interests. And we see now in Iraq direct colonial administration under Governor Bremer trying to take control of Iraq for much longer than they originally had said.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that that poses really, I think there's been a lot of speculation, what's going to be the next war after Iraq? And I think the most likely candidate is Iraq. We see a lot of tensions in southern Iraq between the Shiites and the United States, also in central Iraq between Sunnis and the U.S. So I think that really this kind of neocolonial administration or direct colonial administration is really partly to keep this permanent military presence in Iraq and control over Iraqi oil fields. I think it's very, very dangerous.
Zoltan Grossman is the assistant professor of geography at the University of Wisconsin, Eau Claire.
Got to stand up and not be frightened. Got to speak up. With my voice, I got to hold fast to the things I'm believing. Got to pray and not lose hope. Dark days have come upon us. Our world is spinning out of control. I got to find the voice of peace and reason and not lose hope. Got to listen to the voice within me. Got to question things that I've been told. I got to see out my own liberation. Got to sing and not lose hope. Dark days have come upon us. Our world is spinning out of control. I got to find.
Music by Jane Moore, a local artist from Maryland, entitled Not Lose Hope. The search for alternatives to war in the Middle East is being pursued by progressive-thinking politicians, economists, and citizens worldwide. Now the academic community is utilizing its research on human society and culture to expedite the resolution of hostilities. Farah Charmchi from Pacifica Station KPFT in Houston has the story.
Bruce Wexler, a professor of psychiatry at Yale University, studies brain development and human culture. He's observed, as have many others, that humans are unique in that we both shape and are shaped by our environment. Dr. Wexler began wondering about what implications this finding has for the world of conflict resolution, especially the conflict between Palestinians and Israelis.
People fight to try and control the external public space, their symbols, their beliefs. In that space being prominent. And the Middle East is a place that's just been for centuries of extreme importance symbolically to multiple communities, the Jewish, the Muslim, and the Christian communities. And I didn't think that that particular dimension of the conflict was one that the diplomats and the generals were very sensitive to or very well positioned to deal with. And I wondered for a while where the religious leaders were on the other side of it, why the religious leaders weren't speaking up for the values within each of their cultures that were inconsistent with the violence, and why they weren't upset that the holiest city for their religions was being defiled by violence all the time. And so that prompted me to think how one could intervene in this public idea space, change what's in the public idea space. And the idea would be we can't change cultures, but what we can do is find values within each culture that are supportive of the efforts of mutual understanding. There was a poll conducted by the University of Maryland at the request of an organization called Search for Common Ground, and it found that over 70% of Israelis and over 70% of Palestinians endorsed essentially the same peace plan, and the reservations in each community were only and primarily that there wasn't a partner on the other side, that their view of what they'd be willing to accept for peace would not be accepted by the other side, and that violence would continue to be emanate from the other side.
Dr. Wexler tells about the difficulty of getting even apparently major trends recognized in the news.
Yitzhak Frankenthal started a telephone service in Jerusalem called Hello Shalom and Hello Salam, and that it's staffed by operators, and any Palestinian can call up and say, I want to talk to an Israeli. And any Israeli can call up and say, I want to talk to a Palestinian. In the first 3 months of operation this past fall, there were 130,000 phone calls made. 260,000 people on either ends of those phones talking to each other. No news coverage of that fact in this country. Most people who are very concerned about the problems in the Middle East and follow it closely don't even know this exists.
What he needed now was to discover why this third voice, this alternative voice that he claims represents the mainstream but is radically underrepresented in the media, is so often drowned out or excluded. For this, he began to ask how we frame and analyze the problem of the conflict.
One of the news experts at our meeting was explaining that if you had some news about what you were going to do about the settlement problem or what you were going to do about the governance of Jerusalem, those are the real problems that have to be solved. Is what this news person said. So that's what we report about, things relevant to that. But it depends on what your analysis is. Now, I heard Shlomo Ben-Ami, the former foreign minister of Israel and the chief negotiator at Camp David, and Hassan Rahman, who was in the Palestinian negotiating group at those same meetings, both said to me and said publicly at a meeting here at Yale that the major problem is one of trust. not the particulars of the diplomatic solution. It's a matter of trust. So if you think that that's the problem, then these other images are very newsworthy. But the news editors don't operate with that level of analysis. A big part of the problem, which they weren't able to address, was the issue of trust and mistrust. And it's these other images that have to be in the news to deal with the issue of trust.
Dr. Wexler's response to what he learned at that point was to co-found an organization whose purpose is to change public perceptions, particularly of Palestinians and Israelis, about the good faith of their counterparts in the peacemaking effort.
Our organization, A Different Future, particular approach to this problem is to try and reclaim the public idea space from extremist voices that predominate there currently. The images that we all get to consume from the region are almost entirely images of Palestinians angry at Israelis and Israelis angry at Palestinians. And these images contribute to a sense of irreconcilable difference between the two communities. There's a Palestinian-American poet, Naomi Shihab Nye, who puts the problem very succinctly. She wrote, "We have to shout as moderates, though it's not our style." Now, our organization thinks that the way that moderates should shout is through a sophisticated, professionally developed communication plan. We have brought together religious leaders, scholars who are experts in the area, and communications experts who have done things like anti-drug campaigns, teen tobacco campaigns. We think it's that technology, the same technology and communications expertise that we've developed to such a fine way in this country to convince people, for example, that they should drink Coca-Cola instead of Pepsi or Pepsi instead of Coca-Cola. It's that expertise that moderates should use when we contest the battlefield of ideas and try and reclaim it from extremist voices.
A Different Future, in addition to its media focus, has also planned an upcoming event, which Dr. Wexler explained to us.
Well, the major activity which we have planned for this September, actually, in Washington, September 15th and 16th, is a walk in Washington where the walking groups are going to consist of an imam, a rabbi, a priest, and a minister. These are to be locally self-constituted groups so that they would all come from the same community. But right away, we think that this will help to build interfaith bridges in communities across the country. Our plan is to have 250 of these walking units, 1,000 religious leaders, in Washington, September 15th and 16th. There will be a website called walkinwashington.info, and that will be a place where people can actually get information and sign up. And we're just launching this, and any single religious leader can initiate this by then reaching out to leaders in his or her own community from the other faiths and forming a walking group.
Professor Bruce Wexler's recent article about media coverage can be found in Columbia Journalism Review, which is online at cjr.org, and the website of his organization is www.adifferentfuture.org. This is Farah Charmchi for KPFT Pacifica Radio.
You're listening to Pacifica's Peace Watch. I'm Verna Avery Brown. This is a show about peace, promoting it, preserving it, and monitoring those who would seek to destroy it. We'll be back in a moment.